Good morning.
Oh my goodness.
I know Doug is ready to go this morning, and Kelly's ready to go.
Yes,
and, my seniors, I don't use that.
Senior citizens.
The chronologically advantaged individuals are all here.
Right.
And Mr. Olson is here, so I will open the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. Public hearing on Senate Bill 5527, Department of Human Resources, Director's Office, and welcome. We could have a little sunshine this morning. We do have some individuals in the audience, so let's get started. There are members that are still will be trickling in as they come out of their caucus. So,
Madam Chair, I hope today is the last day of sort of the official public hearings on our department. I'm starting on the book on page 4-40, and we'll finish up this presentation as quickly as possible. Also, I think we need to talk about Senate Bill 288, which we'll do at the end of the presentation, given around some ways we deal with rehab facilities and some changes in law from last session and the instructions to us to do some planning for the future. On page 4-40, we're looking at the Office of Finance and Policy Analysis, which is basically the budget unit for the department. I'm the administrator for that office and report directly to the director and deputy director for that. The programs and services are pretty straightforward. We provide caseload and cost per case forecasting, budget development, execution and monitoring, and fiscal and policy analysis on financial issues and other issues in the department. The mission, the short mission is do good cheap, but that's not our official mission. The official mission is to provide accurate and timely budget and policy-related information and recommendations to department leadership.
You should put that in marble, don't you?
Yeah, all right.
Actually, the...
Right below the Ten Commandments. Oh, excuse me.
Well, I'd rather not go.
Have I lost control of you this morning?
Yep, you have.
We've already had that bill in the floor, so okay.
Madam Chair, you missed the short form of their motto, their official mission. We're going to put it in marbles.
Returning, Madam Chair, to this page 4-40, as I said, our unofficial mission is do good cheap, but the official mission is.
Efficiently.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
economically.
Yeah. That's why it's the unofficial. But anyways, our mission again is to provide accurate and timely information to department leadership, to our policy and field and program staff, and to external policymakers like yourselves, department administration, administrative services, the governor's office, and your staff. Our goals are to provide clear and concise information. Make information readily available to policymakers, budget folks, others that interact with our department. Strengthen the link between the program policy staff and budget staff, which is very important and something we're striving to increase that linkage, because it's so clear that when in forecast, I'm noticing that there's such a clear link between policy and as we forecast costs, make budgets and things. So that's one of the big goals for me over the next year to strengthen that. Provide accurate caseload and cost for case projections, and I use the term accurate as much as we can. There are so many outside factors, just like there are in the state economic forecasts that affect our projections, and to implement standardized approaches to budgeting, which as part of the reorganization effort, we need to move forward in that. We've had basically, 8 budget shops that we are now in the process of coming together. In fact, when Bobby Mink took over the department on February 1st, that was one of his first moves, not only to combine some of the administrative services under Cindy Becker, who you heard from last week, but also to combine the budget staffs of the department under myself. My old role had been more of a coordinator in the budget. Now the staff does report to me directly. During this session, we decided to leave the budget shops and not try to change the format to do that during the session. Probably would have caused some serious problems, and your staff probably would have become quite frustrated because any transition is difficult. But after session, we will be looking at some ways to build on a more coordinated and integrated budget strategy there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duncan.
I'm just curious how you plan to
deal with the inadvertent errors.
Like the Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, like the $180 from last year.
I just love the terminology. I like that.
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, I will tell you, there will be mistakes in an $8.5 billion budget. We will make mistakes. Others will make mistakes.
You mean you're not infallible?
No, Madam Chair.
Nice to know that we're human.
Next year.
Yeah.
Generally, the functions of this office are to basically manage and develop the budget, provide that technical assistance to the offices and various programs of the department on fiscal and program issues. We provide options to the director and department leadership in terms of improving policies, programs, and operations. We're the lead contact on the budget with the legislature and the Department of Administrative Services and the governor. One of our big functions is to monitor changes in federal laws and how that affects the budget, which is a very significant issue for our department, as dependent as we are on federal budget for our budget. We monitor the expenditures of the budget, and one of the growing roles of our office is to forecast the department's caseloads and cost per cases. And on page 443, there are some lists of potential performance and workload measures that we will plan to take a look at that over the next year or two. But this is a service function of the department, so the program outcomes are a little more difficult to define, and they're more like workload measures of one type or another.
Budget.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shue.
Doug, would you comment on bullet 3, measure of linkage between budget and policy? What do you mean by that?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, earlier I talked about my desire to make stronger linkages between the budget staff and program staff than we are now. I don't know what that measure will be. I'm not sure how you quantify that. It's more of a qualitative measure, but it's something that I want to strive for because it's real important. Moving on, members of the committee, I'm going to move to page 5-1, and this gets into the budget of this area of the department. The first section there on 5-1 talks about the budget drivers, what drives the budget, what makes the budget increase, decrease, or whatever in this part of the department. Much of the growth in this department-wide support services is the result of consolidation, which we continue to do as we speak. Back about 5 years ago, about the time, just before I came to the department, many of the department-wide support services, or the first step was taken in consolidating, and approximately a little less than 400 positions were moved out of the divisions into the department-wide support services area. Most of those were information systems and accounting or financial services. And we continue to do that in the areas of personnel or human resources, facilities, contracts, budget, a number of other areas as we further that consolidation into a centralized and coordinated, integrated approach to business services and other support services across the department. Factors that drive our cost in this area, the entire budget, administrative services, department leadership, the Office of Finance and Policy Analysis is federal data tracking reporting requirements or requirements that you may place on us or the Department of Administrative Services, federal and state policy changes, which are big things that affect our department, not only in terms of the budget, but also in terms of reporting requirements, caseload growth. Each time you add a client, you add a certain level of need for administrative functions in terms of accounting and contracts. A good example of that is the implementation of System of Care over the past few years. That System of Care greatly increased the number of contracts that the department has to write because of the nature of individual services designed for the individual client. Under state law, we have to have a contract in any type of that relationship. And we've tried to simplify that process, but we've had to stay within the boundaries of the state law around contracts. And that has been what has led to a very large growth in the number of contracts we write. And again, probably the most driving factor is the increase in the number and complexity of federal reporting requirements. It's just a matter of the financial reports that we just file, all the program reports. A lot of that is done by this, the department-wide support services part of the department. Again, caseload growth drives up the number of transactions. I haven't taken a look at lately, but our department represents over half of the total transactions for the state, for state government, when you factor out higher ed, in terms of the accounting systems and things, and that's rightly so, we're big, but we also serve a lot of clients, and we have a lot of what might be called smaller transactions. They're still relatively large, but when you have to make a client, a payment for a client, for like a TANF grant or a payment to a provider, to a hospital or in-home client, each of those are an individual transaction, and they're still, they're automated, but it still adds workload.
Thank you.
Senator Duncan.
Doug, you may not have this at the tip of your fingers here. I just was curious. And I think you folks told us once before, but I've forgotten now. How many people are involved in programs with DHS right now?
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, the term of the number of clients.
Well, I realize you have duplicates, you know, but how many people in Oregon, you suppose, right now are?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, I think Mr. Mink talked about this. We went back through our charts or our records and did a good estimation for fiscal year 1999, which is quite recent.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that we touch over 900,000 Oregonians, unique number during that period for some type of assistance. Keep in mind, though, we actually, you know, in some way, serve the entire population. For example, is the health division,
right,
say drinking water, restaurant inspections, mm-hmm, and those kinds of things. But individual clients toward a specific program, we're looking at over 900,000.
So that's
a large
third plus,
yeah,
of the people in the state of Oregon.
It is.
Madam
Senator Yee,
is this for 10 years, 900,000 people over 10 years?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that was for fiscal year 1999, I believe.
Oh.
That was, it included all the OHP clients, all the food stamp clients, all our TANF, foster care, mental health, whatever it might be, but that totaled somewhere just over 900,000 different people.
Another question.
Follow up,
Madam Chair. Doug, you mentioned about caseload growth. Now, for 0103, how much caseload growth are you allowing? I thought it was very restricted.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, with our caseload projections, and there is the caseload directly to this part of the department, but across the department, we have used what we call the no-flex forecast. We have a baseline forecast we now predict, and at the same time, we take a look at what we'll call the no-flex, which is a tighter set of assumptions, and it does reduce the number of clients. And so there is still growth in our caseload. Good example, yesterday I talked about the food stamp caseload. Just this biennium has increased over 4,000 in the last rebalance. That translates to almost a 30,000 case growth in the next biennium as those lines continue. And that is under our no-flex assumptions. Health plan continues to grow. The CHIP program continues to grow. Another area of significant growth is the long-term care system, the seniors system, and that continues to grow. So even with the no-flex caseload, there is caseload growth. I would have to go back and sort of sum up all of them to get you a count. We can do that if you wish. It would take a few days, though.
So, no-flex caseload growth means you have some growth,
yeah,
but not the way you predict population growth.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, what we first do, and this is new for us, it's something we've started just basically in the last 6 months. The forecasting staff that works for me, and in some cases the divisions on other programs, provide what we'll call a baseline forecast, and that is our generally what we've used in the past. It is our best, what we would say, if you took a point in time and tried to forecast out, you think about a cone that goes out of an upper boundary and a lower boundary, and that baseline is in the middle, generally, of that cone. The no-flex is a tighter set of assumptions. We, for example, say we don't think the long-term care system will grow as much because we don't think the senior population given factors, may not grow as much. So that line is slightly below that baseline. That is what we'll call the no-flex caseload line, or a set of assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
It's still growing in many of the programs.
But a little more conservative.
Yep. It's mm-hmm. You got to use the term conservative.
What would happen if the growth is higher than no-flex, and you have no reserve for the growth in your budget?
Madam Chair, there is no reserve at this time.
Mm-hmm.
We would have to, as we do in any type of rebalance, come back with you to the emergency board with a set of options that would, have certain types of management actions, a term that some people don't like to see because it's more than a management action. It would be a program cut of some type, whether in our own administration or in the program itself. Over the last few years, since we were a department, we come into rebalances, and there are positives and negatives off our forecast and amount across programs. We've been very lucky for a long time and have not had to directly access the emergency fund. We've been able to balance over time. That will likely become, with the no-flex set of caseloads, a little more difficult to do because we have a tighter caseload assumptions. So you may see us back a little different pattern from the emergency board.
Madam Chair. I think with the slower economy, you probably will have more growth in cases and much less money to come up for emergency makeup. So this is going to be a very tough budget.
Well, we all know that. We knew that when we hit the gavels coming into the building that it was going to be a tough budget. But I think that they do have the opportunity, even with the projection that we're going to, that it's slow growth, to come to this, to the e-board and others to make the adjustments that they require in order to get through the biennium.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we work closely with your staff and DAS staff on, basically a monthly basis during the interim, but we do come back approximately every 6 months for rebalance. And Senator Yee, you've been part of that for years in that process.
We're going to have them come back and provide us with consultation.
Madam Chair, we have...
Not after all those statements I heard about volunteers and I'm remembering.
You have a good memory. Yeah, absolutely.
Madam Chair, we have no consultation fees on that side built into the budget at this time.
No consultation.
Madam Chair, I'm going to move on to page 5-3, which gets into a little more budget detail. This pie chart, and this is total funds in terms of the governor's recommended budget, the total fund budget of the entire department is about $8.4 billion. Of that 8.4, a little under 2%, 1.8%, is what we've been presenting here over the past couple of weeks in terms of the department-wide support services. And then you can see the breakdown of the rest of the department there. If you turn the page to 5-4, this is more specific to that 1.8%. In terms of FTE, you've heard descriptions this week and last week of the various components of this part of the department, and this is the breakdown by FTE at the top graph. By far, information systems is the largest component of that, representing over half the staff. Accounting represents about 20%, and then you can go around the chart and you see where most of how the staff breakdown. In terms of sort of organizational structure, what Cindy Becker presented to you last week was the term administrative services, and that represents almost 90% of the staff in this area because of information systems and accounting and communications and others, which are the large components of the staff in this. The budget, which is the bottom chart on 5-4, using the same groupings, you can see that it's basically not that much different than FTE because this budget is generally driven by staff, whether they're accountants, whether they're our systems design, whether they're personnel officers for the department. The difference we made is information systems, for example, And there are large amounts of contract money in there because we do contract out a lot for systems development. And I'm sure there'll be some discussion around the MMIS system about contracting out as we go through the next biennium.
Chairman.
Senator Hartung.
Doug, do you see any prospect for, using new technology and whatnot to reduce, for instance, I see 19.2% in accounting on FTEs and the budget's 12.5. Do you see any prospect for reducing those parts of the cost of the operation?
Good question.
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, we have an automated accounting system now, but there's still a lot of double checking that staff have to do, a lot of what we'll term reconciliation, a lot of processing. If anything, what we want to do is get rid of the paper, but that processing still, even if it's online, the processing still occurs. A lot of what they do is double check what the system does, and we do find mistakes. There's always the inadvertent input mistakes that people make or whatever it is. It's still a people-driven system, but it is very automated. We share the accounting system with most of state government. We also have a number of payment systems that we have to maintain. I think Cindy talked about over 50 payment systems that the department runs. We do have many. Unfortunately, it takes money to replace those. And many of them are old, and we're addressing those with one of the packages I'll talk about in a minute. But I think we've done a lot of automation. What we've done is tried to hold the lid on increasing the staff as the workload or the number of transactions or the number of clients we serve have increased.
Madam Chairman, I hope in your conversation with Tommy Thompson, you'll explain to him the tremendous burden it puts on the states, with the paperwork and so forth. Do you think there's an opportunity that this administration is going to change that?
I think there are several opportunities. Because I was listening to the Doug, I think that probably the conversation should be held with the federal counterpart because we react to their needs. Mm-hmm. And a part of looking, if I can recall, the days of block grant funding, and that was during the Nixon years. Boy, I'm dating myself. It wasn't cumbersome in the reporting process, and I would hope that that Tommy Thompson, in fact, it might be well of sending a letter to the president, as one of his policy issues mm-hmm. that he may want to work with all the federal agencies. And we get accused of at the state level of having to pass it on to the local jurisdictions, but that's mm-hmm. because we're being forced by the federal level to have all of these so-called accountability responses.
Why don't you mention it to him the next time you're cuddling with him?
Next time I go back to Washington and I cuddle with George W. the president. He didn't see my picture.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm glad to know that it was a picture.
It was a picture. He's not like that other guy. but I do think it's worthy of communication with Washington to suggest that they look at this very, very cumbersome and convoluted reporting system that comes out of their agency. We spend a lot more time than I think we need to on all this reporting that we do, and the volumes of forms and things that we have to fill out just increases both staff and time and slows down the delivery system, quite honestly, when you really begin to analyze it. So I will make a note of that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the federal government is a driver of workload across the department.
Yeah.
I also want to remind members that, you look at the staff and the number and those, keep in mind we are an $8 billion organization, whether it's a business or not. And if you looked at other large organizations, you would see staff in the financial areas, the personnel areas, or whatever it is, probably at least at rates like as we do. And we need to keep that in mind that we are a large organization. The federal government does contribute a large of workload in terms of reporting. We do depend on them for a lot of dollars. But in the operation of any organization this large, you're going to have that oversight, or you're going to get a lot more negative auditor reports for example, about us, and we've got to be careful and keep that in our minds.
I don't think that's the issue. I think often, and I know, not unless it's changed since I was over on your side of the aisle, that where sometimes we get requests from the federal government, we scratch our heads and we wonder why they even requested that information in the first place. And it would be really nice if they did like we did several years ago, and I hope we do it again, where we had to go through what we're doing and to really analyze the validity of what we were asking for and the validity of whether the form and whether it was actually needed and how much duplication was really occurring within the information collection data systems that we threw out there. So I think, to me, those are some of the healthy questions to ask the federal government.
You know, just thinking.
Senator Duncan.
I remember it's so easy to... You know, different groups had different reports, and I just think in my days as state superintendent, what we did, I called dummy district number one. And so everything that went out to a school district, a copy went into dummy district number one, which I got. And so I had a chance to review everything they were getting. And it was amazing the number of times one part of the agency was sending this out. And I'd say, wait a minute, you know, why are we asking this and why are we getting together? And we were able to cut down a lot of things. But, I mean, it's inadvertent, I mean, that people are doing that. But it's just, it's a tough job. And the bigger the agency, the tougher it gets to try to, and the federal government has the same problem. So we have to keep monitoring that, watching for inadvertent errors.
That's what I'm really excited about, you know, what the department is embarking on.
I think
as far as looking at its reorg, because it will get at some of this overlap and duplication when you really begin to analyze it, and so that we're not really filling our system to the point of where we're nothing but paper, we're nothing but a collection of data and systems. At least the system, the data can come together into one stream. So that's, I'm very excited about that. In fact, I'm writing a letter to Secretary Page to see if we can't get his cooperation with the Voc Rehab piece. We do have the partnering with the Human Services piece with Tommy Thompson. So but I think it's exciting. Oregon would be in the forefront of the country with this kind of organizational system. But,
if we cut out our inadvertent errors and went more to calculated errors, we'd be okay, wouldn't we?
All right. You know, with that, we have discussed this issue. Go ahead, Doug.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on page 5-5, this area of the department is by funding source. The majority of it, almost 80%, is other funds. And these are generally for the services. We charge the programs, the divisions for the services that these folks provide. It is based on a federal cost allocation plan that's approved by the federal government. Other funding sources are listed there at the bottom of the page. We are directly funding into this organization things like the Medicaid Management Information Systems package, and then there's Lifespan Respite Care.
Can we ask a question on 5-4?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And in the bottom it says administrative services 85%. Is there an inadvertent error?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we put that there because, again, this is a combined unit. It combines everything that's white on that chart.
See?
They add up those percentages, unless there's an inadvertent error, that should add to 85%. And those are the functions that are part of our administrative services division that's headed up by Cindy Becker, who was here last week.
Just once again, to kind of get on the record, in the sense, again, the terminology, administrative services, probably a better terminology would be operational services, because the connotation between administration and
Senator Duncan, I want you to know, and the other committee members to know, that I do carry your messages. I have had the conversation with Mike Greenfield and have asked him to look at this whole definition of what's administrative and what have you, and so I know that the DAS is looking at the same questions that we raised, but just so that you know that,
for sure,
that messages do get passed on.
Glad you're whispering in his ear, too.
Huh?
I'm glad you're whispering in his ear, too.
Madam. What does this group this morning.
What is this?
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
I hate to disagree with Senator Duncan, but you can't go from administrative services to operational services, or DAS would become OAS.
Oh, God. Hey. Continue, Ms. Wilkins. We're falling apart.
I'm going to move on, Madam Chair, to page 5-6. And I'll go through this quickly because you'll review this again in work session. But this is basically how the budget for this part of the department is built. The base budget is at the top of page 5.6 or 5-6. And this is basically where we start in the 9901 budget, and we start building it. The essential packages are listed on the next few pages. I think the key here is a couple points I want to make on what happens in terms of getting to the current service level. The lifespan respite care, which makes up a large share of that general fund, is a program about two sessions ago. That was a bill that passed overwhelmingly by the legislature that expanded that. Established the lifespan respite care program, but it was going to be phased in over three biennia, and this is the final phase in of that program for the final 12 counties. Another key to look, and I'm going to look at page 5-7 there, in the other funds and under program adjustments, the current service level actually decreases mainly because we pull out the remaining Y2K expenditures out of the budget. As we move forward. So that's the largest adjustment in driving in terms of building this budget. The total essential packages growth in our budget is a little over $400,000 or about $461,000 of general fund, a negative growth in the other funds, and that is the Y2K adjustment. And other growth is around some grants that we have received approved by the E-Board that are being built into the budget, as well as a phase in of respite care, as I said.
Madam Chair.
Senator Yee.
Doug, can you refresh our memory? How much money do we appropriate for Y2K adjustments?
In the last biennium, that was estimated at about $15.7 million. And then there were, and that figures on the top of page 5-8, the first line there. That's what we took out of the budget. And that was for the 9901, and there was funding, actually more money in the 9799 budget for Y2K. I don't know what that figure is. I'd have to get that. But if my recollection is right, we spent somewhere around, in terms of total funds, probably around $45 million. That's a rough estimate for Y2K over two biennia.
What's the provision to give bonuses for completion of the Y2K project early? Was that an overall state government decision?
Madam Chair, there were long discussions, and I can't remember how many years ago around that. We were participating in those discussions as well as DAS and other large agencies, so there was a large discussion. I'm not sure what other agencies did. Our concern of that was losing key people, mainly because many of our systems were older systems written in COBOL, and we actually had to train a number of folks throughout the department, and we established a training program to teach folks COBOL because they're not teaching it anymore because it's such an archaic language in terms of programming. So they were part of the budget, and that was a statewide discussion. I'm not sure what other agencies did in that area.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duncan.
Yeah, I was chairing the Joint Legislative Information Committee during all of this time. And
were you whispering in the ears of those who
were? Yes, that's what I'm doing right now. but anyhow, trying to keep staff was absolutely a terrible task because the industry was having the same problem. And we'd get someone trained, and they'd come over and offer a $20,000 salary increase from the leave state government. And so we really had to be competitive. And the interesting thing about it, I keep hearing people say, we spent all that money and there was no problem. Well, true. We spent all that money and there was no problem. I can assure you, if we'd not spent that money, there would have been some problems. I keep thinking that the night of the turnover at midnight, I was at a friend's home, and I was on call from here to be alerted of any major problems, and I didn't get a call, and it was a wonderful feeling, let me tell you. So I think that our staffs throughout the state government did a fantastic job of averting, inadvertently, no, planned aversion of really doing a good job of getting this. Because people would have been unhappy if it had fallen apart. It could have.
Madam Chair, continuing along, there are reductions, and Kelly outlined them last week. I'm on page 5.5-9. You can see in the middle of the page there, there are about $273,000 worth of general fund reductions and total fund being a little over $2 million. Those come in three areas. The Klamath Adolescents Program, the Albina, and Klamath Adolescents Program is a program, actually, it'd probably be best to move to page 5-11. I can go through each of those reductions a little more. The Klamath Adolescents Program serves females 13 to 17 years of age in Klamath County. It was reduced in the, or eliminated in the governor's budget because it was not a statewide program. I think Kelly talked about that. This will give you a little background on that program. And I think in some of the questions that we, responses to your questions that I gave you late last week also has more detail in there for you. The Albina Emergency Services Program is a program in Northeast Portland that we've funded for a number of years. We actually fund it and get federal funds and general fund out of our department and send that to the Housing and Community Services Department, who actually then contracts or operates that Albina Emergency Shelter Services along with the community and the local governments in that area. That was eliminated out of the budget, as well as community partnership team resources in our department. And this includes our volunteer program and some other programs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duffy.
Will we lose some matching funds then?
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, in this case, you will. There are no matching funds in the Klamath Adolescents Program. There are some in Albina, you know, for example, whatever we use. We use this, what we call the pro rate. We charge a certain amount out to the divisions that probably benefit or whose clients benefit from this program, and we will lose some federal matching funds as a result.
When you say some, is that a significant figure?
Well, it roughly, and each program is slightly different, is probably about 50% federal and other funds and 50% general for these.
This Albina Emergency Services Program, this is the one on Martin Luther King Boulevard?
I guess is that the
this
one.
This is the one that was started when I was with the Albina War on Poverty.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Shields.
I would just like to point out that in each of these eliminations or reductions, you're going to end up spending more money than you save. And I as much as possible, I'll guarantee it. Because each of those programs will have a consequent ripple effect back in the criminal justice system. Other systems will pick up the costs. What you save here. There's no doubt about it. And even when you get down to the community partnership team, the idea is that we're trying to get more volunteerism. How can you get more volunteerism when you're reducing the size of the operation that create volunteers? You know, their job is to do that. So these don't make sense. I mean, I understand all the budget drivers that we have, but I just... pointing out a flaw in the logic.
Two of the
Manager.
Just a second. Go ahead.
Where are the five offices that are going to close with community partnership?
I will have to check on that. I'm not sure. And that was an estimate back from the governor's mouth.
Doug, would you explain for us that on the Albina Emergency Service, and you have other funds, but isn't that really general funds that come back as an expense?
Madam Chair, we can get these numbers, and I don't know, Tammy, do you have, okay, we can get the exact numbers for each of these, but what we do is that there's a total fund amount, and what we try to do in our pro rate or in our cost allocation, some of that is general fund out in the divisions, and some of it's federal funds, for example. and when they get to us, they become other funds as we pay it out. But there are general funds dollars attached to that. And if you'd like to know in terms of each of these three, we can get you that information.
Yeah. Madam Chair?
Senator Duncan.
That's the question I would have. And remember, I don't like to generate a lot of work for you, so I'm just curious to what you have it available. In many cases, we've recommended reduction of a program, but there is a federal impact. So I'd be kind of curious how many federal dollars will we be losing? What's the trade-off?
Yeah, and we will get those numbers.
Okay, now, if it's a lot of work,
I don't think
is that national?
Because we do keep track of these dollars. The community partnership team, and we'll have to find out exactly, but with reorganization, it may not occur because as we switch the way we do field services, the volunteer program, for example, be part of that structure. So I'm not sure if we've actually identified in the old structure what those would be. We're estimating based on the staff reductions there. And it will have an impact on the volunteer program. But again, our hope is that reorganization, that function will move toward that integrated field and also makes the way we do the volunteer program may change at the management level on how we do things and hopefully alleviate the impact of much of that reduction. In terms of the reductions, we did take all of the reductions that we put up out of department-wide support service was taken by the governor. That's on the bottom of page 5-12. Policy packages from the governor's recommended budget, there's one package, right? Yeah, with two components. And both of these, you will be getting recommendations from the e-government committee chaired by Representative Hill, and I think the majority of that committee comes from this subcommittee. So they fully funded, if my recollection is right, this package. It deals with two of our major programs, or the recommendation was to fully fund it. The Medicaid Management Information Systems, or MMIS, which is what I'll call the granddaddy of our systems because so much of our budget flows through it because of the Medicaid program. It's a payment system. It's a client tracking system. It's a record-keeping system, and it dates back to the late 70s. We actually took this. We took the program from, I believe, the state of Missouri, and made it work for Oregon back a number of years ago, and that's where we get back to the COBOL programming. I think MMIS is in COBOL. I could be wrong.
You mean the Show Me State produced something that we could copy?
Well, at least back in the 70s they did, Madam Chair. And that system was built on the concept of fee-for-service and is based in the Medicaid program has changed significantly since then, both at the state level and the federal level, and this is our number one priority in terms of new systems development, as Senator Yee has encouraged us strongly to keep in mind. The bad news is this will cost at least $100 million, we estimate probably more. The good news is the majority of these funds are 90% federal, 10% state, and that. So, and it is a multi-year project. We want to move as quick as feasible on this, but at the same time, we don't want to move too quick that we make mistakes and move too far in front of ourselves in developing this system. The second part of that package, members of the subcommittee.
I just want to add that we don't know exactly how much it's going to cost. It depends on what the business plan, what the RFP will tell us, and I'm hoping that we can contract it out. One, it will be faster. I'm a contractor that can provide the service so that it can be provided faster and at much less cost. But it all depends on the plan they're going to present to the technology committee and to the emergency board, depending on what it says. But I'm very happy they have a work group that will invite large provider, community provider, physicians association, hospital associations, large and small providers, so they will have input and make sure that it will meet all the needs of the providers, and hopefully we'll have accurate data soon. It doesn't sound soon enough, but I guess you have to go through the planning stage.
And plus, you have to make sure that they don't get the same consultant that did motor vehicles.
No.
Madam Chair.
We don't want to.
Madam Chair, keep in mind this is one of the largest systems in state government currently, and it will remain so. So you want to be careful.
I do know there is some concern on the part of the chair of advancing youth government that the person that is responsible for the information tech systems have a direct reporting line to the director. He's expressed that to me, and I'm sure he's expressed that to you. So because of the magnitude of the project and always in this kind of thing, there are some evolving decisions that must be made, and so I share that
Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. The way those things operate now, we learned a lot from the DMV project. We can be critical of DMV, but in a sense, DMV was very, very helpful to us in learning what not to do. And so a lot of the whole system of checks and balances and so forth are really well done nowadays. So I'm not expecting another DMV fiasco, because I think they served the rest of state government well by showing us what not to do. And I can't imagine a director, and I don't know if they need a director from us, but I can't imagine a director who isn't going to be close to that task nowadays with their skin and everything is on the line. That sort of thing.
I think it's just the balance caution, Senator Hartford.
Yeah, Doug, several times you've mentioned, you know, how big DHS is, $8 billion. And for me and for you, and I hope Bobby Mink, this gives you an opportunity to do some things, to use some technology. And once again, without apology, I go to Intel, $186 billion a year company, and they have streamlined their operation and improved services to their clientele and had efficiencies that only a big company of that size. So you have an opportunity here now. So I don't want you, if the reorg doesn't go just right, say, well, we're too big, it didn't work. It's big enough that you can make it work, man.
I'm going to ask them, because I think that Intel and business sector, we do things because we have both the ability and it's profit-driven. Sometimes I think the agency could do some things that, when we have to remember that we, too, can provide some of the impediments that keep them from doing the job that they want to do. And so we do share in this whole piece. And unlike Intel, you know, their board of directors say, we want you to be efficient and what have you, and don't put the same kind of constraints that sometimes that we do in this body. And so I'm mindful that it isn't always the agency, you know, the willingness is there. I do think this is an extreme opportunity for us in Oregon. And I would agree that you use the business model as much as you can, and maybe remind us that not to often get in your way.
Right, Madam Chair.
And still retain the accountability that we need to have.
Right, I agree with you completely, and I didn't want to give the idea that, you know, the bottom line is certainly different than Intel's is. Profit, but you know, the profit for us, profit for DHS, is taking care of our clientele in the most efficient way possible. And I think we can measure that. And I think, and I hope Bobby Mink or whoever is the CEO will, you know, stand right up and tell the 90 of us, you know, now if you want this DHS to operate efficiently in delivering services, quality services, you cannot do what you're asking us to do. I mean, we have a focused on a mission, and in order to complete that mission timely and efficiently, why we have to do certain things. And I think it takes a whole different mindset. It's a new culture, in my opinion, on delivering state services to the clientele and our people. And, you know, and I applaud DHS for the interest. And I know early on it said, well, you know, most of your personnel, you know, are social workers, or a lot of them are, and so they want to help, and they try to help, and in some ways, why we have made it more difficult for them to do their job, we'd be in the legislature. So I hope of this new millennium, we have an opportunity to do something differently.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
I'm thinking of specific programs where sometimes we take a tool out of the toolbox of the social worker to do something that's efficient. So as you look through this budget, be looking at programs that are there, programs that we maybe shrink, make it harder for them to do the efficient thing. And I'd be glad to talk to you more about that as we go along. Because I've seen example after example, and in fact, this one on volunteerism. That's one of them.
Yeah.
If you cripple an organization's ability to recruit, maintain, nurture volunteers, then you'll have less volunteers. And those volunteers fill in a lot of significant places. It's just one example of many.
Madam Chair, we do view, I mean, we try to take, where appropriate, the business view of the world. Couple examples. Our new deputy, Donnie Griffin, most of his time has been spent in the business community with a large corporation, but he'll bring a much different view than some other folks will. And in many ways, you are our board of directors, and we need to keep that in mind, and the taxpayers are our shareholders, in a sense, and we need to keep that in mind. But there are some differences, too. There are many of our programs in the business, on the private sector side, as the economy scales down or slows down, business often slows down, and there's a different dynamic for us in many of our programs. When the economy slows, our business, quote unquote, picks up because of caseloads, things like food stamps and potentially TANF and some of those things. So we try to keep that in mind, but we also have to recognize that we work in a different environment than the private sector does, and we've got to keep that in mind in the way we operate. Moving on, Madam Chair. 5-15, the second part of that major package here is a replacement of the mental health payment processing systems. And there are really three components to this: the community contracts database, the quiet process monitoring system, or CPMS, and the accounts receivable system. Just like MMIS, this is a crucial payment system and tracking system for us on those things that are usually run through our county partners. The mental health programs, the programs for near persons with development disabilities, and our A&D programs. And we know we get lots of calls that may come from you because of constituents that are not paid always in a timely manner. And that is one of the reasons that we have this problem, is this older system that's based on software that I remember using in graduate school called RBase, which is a very old database system. So, and we're in the process of wanting to replace this system too. Madam Chair, that sort of takes care of the budget discussion, and of course you will be returning to that during work session as we work through this budget. On page 5-17, there were two budget notes, both of them with related to information systems, that were in last year's or last biennium's or last session's budget report, excuse me. The first one dealt with Y2K, the second one with Medicaid Management Information Systems, or MMIS, both of them reporting requirements, and we feel that we have met those, and we came back to the JLCIMT on a regular basis to report on both of those systems or projects. One note on information systems.
Madam Chair, when you say on a regular basis, I think the Advancing E-Government recommendation is report on a quarterly basis and
right,
with a copy to the Human Resources Subcommittee members.
Just like the emergency board, we will probably be in front of the IMT committee every single time just because of the number of systems of expenses. I do want to make one more sort of note on the budget, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, in terms of information systems. We have HIPAA, which all of you have heard about, which is the Health Insurance Portability Act. I can't remember the name of it exactly. But that is a major new set of requirements, again, by the federal government around healthcare systems. It affects us. It affects other state departments. And it also affects the private sector in terms of medical providers, insurers, and the such. There's nothing in the budget specifically for that set of requirements that we must adjust to over the next few years. So we will be having to carve resources out of existing resources to meet that. And we're still, all the federal requirements have yet to come as part of that act. So it is a large unknown, and again, I'm sure the JLCIMT committee will be hearing about HIPAA on a regular basis, both from us and by this DAS and state government as a whole. But I need to remind you that, while that will be a function we will have to do, there is nothing specifically added to the budget for that. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, on 5-18 are the list of audits that affect this area. The first one is the change of administrator audits for the health division, both rehab division and SCF, over the past 2 years. There were a number of findings in there, and we have implemented or are in the process of implementing those findings. And second, there was the fiscal year end 2000 statewide audit, and there were no findings directly attached to department-wide support services or were in other parts of the department, and we are also addressing all of those findings. We also have a list of we have an internal audit function, and we had a list of the types of things they do earlier on in this presentation. It was last week, but they also do a number of audits, and if anyone would like some details around that, we can get that to you too. But we have an audit committee that selects areas of audit based on risk and continues to do a good set of internal auditors. I think that was one of the more very valuable additions in last year's budget, or last millennium's budget, in terms of adding internal auditor functions to the department. There are three items left to cover today, basically three reports that we were instructed to bring forward. The first one starts on 5-20, and this is something that's existing in state law, in ORS 417-270. It's a requirement that we come back every biennium to the legislature and report on equal access to services for girls and boys. The term of art in this is gender equity, and we take this very seriously. We have an internal work group that deals with gender equity issues. It also has members from the outside that have direct interest. There's a coalition of, I can't remember the exact title, a coalition for advocates for equal access for girls that sit on our committee, that's Pam Patton, as well as a provider representative. Other agencies like the commission and OYA have the same type of, maybe slightly different, but the same type of internal grouping in taking a look at the requirements. There is a 30-page report as part of your appendix. I'm not going to go through it unless you would really like me to. But the major contents of that report are there's the required data that divides up key services by female, or boys and girls and female and male, for mental health, A&D, SCF, AFS, those services that have some type of gender division to them. Other programs like the health plan, in a sense, are not necessarily gender specific. They aren't designed for things, and we serve all that come that are eligible for those programs. Another work product out of this group was a draft policy dealing specifically with gender equity needs across the department, and pointing out and requiring us to think about, in terms of all our program policies that we put out, that gender equity must be a component in that, and also in terms of increasing training of our staff around gender equity issues. That policy has now been approved by the director, and we will be implementing that across the departments in the very near future. So, and then the individual divisions have their specific activities around gender equity are outlined in that report. And for example, Mental Health Division has developed and is implementing rules that require providers of intensive mental health services to demonstrate gender responsiveness in the way they design their programs and the competency of their staff and services. And one thing, and I mentioned this, we've identified training of our staff as a key issue, and we'll be putting training components in specifically directed to gender equity issues. So this report will be sent to the presiding officers, but we needed it also to present it to you to meet the statutory requirements. The second report is around the Oregon Employment Initiative. This is a report that generates out of the January 2001 meeting of the E-Board. They wanted an update on where we are. What we did at that time, with an agreement with the Emergency Board and the subcommittee, was to put together a single unit in the department to administer 4 grants specifically and overall the employment areas of the department. And we have put that group together. There's a governing committee made up of administrators that have programs that deal with our employment initiatives, mental health, SDSD, folk rehab, AFS. The director sits on that grouping, and there is a report at the back that outlines this more specifically. But the overall mission of this group is to coordinate our services in this area. We've established the department governing committee that I just mentioned, and we've put together the staff unit and completing the hiring in the most recent grant to do these, and we have a coordinated approach in managing these grants as well as the various employment initiatives across the department. That group right now reports to the director's office, actually to me. After we reorganize, it may have a different reporting responsibility, but right now it's a department-wide responsibility, so it's just part of the director's office. And they're also working closely with outside organizations.
Does this mean you're going to consolidate all the employment activities into one unit instead of one in each of those 4 divisions?
Madam Chair, Senator, we looked at that in our overall planning for reorganization.
Mm-hmm.
And there are distinct differences in the employment programs. They need coordination, but there are distinct differences between, for example, the self-sufficiency employment and training around AFS. And those employment activities around, let's say, mental health or DD. There are some distinct differences, so we are trying to put that under a single unit, but we're elevating the importance of trying to get those folks to work together as part of reorg. It's one of those, what I'll call it, I think Bobby called it, referred to as horizontal linkages across the department in terms of the reorganization. We actually toyed at one time thinking about a single area just for employment, but after the discussions it started disjointing from the other programs, and we felt that as long as we have that horizontal linkage, we can still meet what we really want to in this, in terms of coordinated employment activities across the department.
Madam Chair, I just feel this is a good time for you to, during your reorganization, to combine those units, maybe do, because when you do recruitment from employers, that's about the same, isn't it? You send outreach to employers to say there are employees available. I mean, there are a lot of efforts you can do more efficiently when you're in one unit.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think those are the types of things we want to coordinate. Mm-hmm. But you also have to remember that many of the employment-related policies are tied so linked so closely with the programs themselves, like our self-sufficiency efforts and the TANF program, that those are key linkages. If you broke them apart, I think you would probably do, we're concerned about breaking apart those things, even administrative or program-wise, that the good benefits of that program, the good successes we've had, would probably start to degenerate a little. I think as long as we have the horizontal linkages and we stress that, very importantly across the department, I think we can achieve what you're after. Mm-hmm. We will look for those kinds of sort of like the employee advertising or whatever you want to call it, the recruitment or for employment opportunities mm-hmm. for these folks. So we will work closely with that, as well as we work with our partners, workforce investment groups out in the community, the employment department, and those folks.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. I really think you should merge these 4 different employment initiatives into the large employment department, because you can even achieve more efficiency and maybe reach out to more employers by going a step further. But this is, you know, this is what my thinking is. I think Representative Schrader expressed the same interest to see if there's more you can gain by combining them and move them into the employment department.
Then it would be nice if the employment department was back in human service.
They moved out, didn't they?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, the last item that I...
Senator Hartung.
Yeah, sorry. Doug. we're doing the K-12 budget right now in the sub on Ed, and Representative Winters and Schrader are on the committee also, and it is just amazing, you know, how the needs in education are growing, special ed, autistic children, and so forth, and who are the coordinators, or what is the coordination between DHS and Department of Education in servicing those kids?
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, in our area, the DD office of the Mental Health Division is the one that's responsible for that population in terms of the responsibilities we have. We have recently, or will in the very near future, sign an agreement with the Department of Education around that because of some federal requirements. But we continue to work, but you probably understand better than I do in terms of the responsibilities of school districts and others in special education.
Mm-hmm.
Ours are less on the education, more on the care, daily living needs in those folks or those folks. There are some crossover. And this is one of the areas we also try to be as creative as possible with Medicaid dollars around this area. And we do have agreements with school districts around using Medicaid dollars for some of the services where applicable and where eligible under the Medicaid laws as much as we can. So we do have a close relationship. As you well know, that sometimes school districts like to act independently of the state, and I'm sure that's maybe a surprise to many of you. And the challenge is to get all this, you know, it's one thing to have that relationship with the Department of Education. You also have that relationship on the local business.
Right, but the point is, they want to be independent, but they want the money from us. So that makes it a little bit difficult.
It's your challenge.
This is a whole new ball game, as they say, in taking care of these kids. Yesterday, we had from the Lincoln County ESD a film on the success that they're having with these kids, the Down syndrome kids and autistic kids. And I tell you, I had a lump in my throat the whole time watching that, because it wasn't too many years ago we would put them out at Fairview, institutionalize these kids. I know we had 3,500 children like out there at one time, but we really need to find some resources, because we have proved that we can, if we get these kids early enough, we have proved that we can, you know, help them be productive citizens. And it, but to me, I mean, we are so, you know, departmentalized. I don't see the partnering or the cooperative effort that we simply must have if we're going to do anything in that area.
Senator Hartung, BRD also works with the Department of Ed, but also keep in mind that the children's plan, which is to look at planning and coordination of data, they're, part of that is linking education in a part of that plan. And, you know, I went and visited with the local Healthy Start, and it was interesting to me to note that all the agencies were there but Ed. And I think that there needs to be some push that Ed needs to be at the table when, particularly in the local planning arena, for these linkages. You know, it's not just one-sided. The agency, the human resource agencies were all there, and there is this overlap. There is this need for this collaboration in order to provide the services that are needed, whether we're talking about the autistic child or the child with Down syndromes and what have you. And I would totally agree with you, and I know that the children's plan does bring all of them at the table.
Yeah.
And that's kind of interesting that they all need to begin to talk and to work together to make sure that we're doing a much better job for children.
You know, it's interesting. At one time, Leo Hegstrom and I had that going. We had this, in fact, the first meeting was at the Holiday Inn up in Wilsonville, and it really got started. We really had it going. And then there was a change of governor, and they said, no, that's not, and you threw it all out. And then you have to go back and start all over again. I tell you, we go inside, and it was a great, you know, they have to be at the table. at first, when we first brought together, education sat on that side, human services sat on this side. And before long, we had them all mixed up. You couldn't have told the difference, and that's the way it should be, because it all fits together.
It's same conceptually is what we're talking about. The issue of, and I go back to the reorg, because it's the same issue. It's not just voc rehab. It's not just adult and family services. It's not just services to children and families. We have to get away from this notion that we have about how we deliver services. That all the clients are out there begging us to stop these walls and divisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they're saying, you know, our needs are here, and because of your walls that you have put up, that we're not really adequately being served. And it's the recognition that individuals anymore have multiple needs. That we're education can't be isolated from human services, and so it's tearing down the, I call it the territorial wall, because that's really what it is. And so that we're working together for the benefit of the citizen themselves. They are our customer. They're where the services should be driven in concert with each other. And I'm just kind of, you'd be maybe on the threshold for once of really really talking together, and not just talking, but actually putting our resources jointly together to solve some problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the state and its citizens would be the big, huge benefactor of that. So sometimes it takes us a long time. I sat here and I, in fact, called Ed Westerdahl the other day, because he was the architect of the McCall administration for creating the Department of Human Resources. And I said, 30 years later, would you believe, I called him down in Palm Springs, would you believe that we're talking about doing what you wanted to do 30 years ago?
Mm.
And that was to make sure that the client was at the center of the service delivery, and that we had one common intake to make it happen.
Interesting you say that, because when, you know, I first came to the legislature in 1967, and in the 8 years of the McCall administration, I was 4 years in the House and 4 years in the Senate, and of course we did a lot of really great things, the beach bill, the bottle bill, and land use planning and zoning. But I say, if Tom McCall was here today, he would be saying exactly what you have said. He would be leading the way on education, but with our children, too. And that's very interesting that Ed Westerdahl... Can we get him back up here and put him to work?
You know, I thought it would be kind of nice if we, when we get all this through, to invite him to come.
Absolutely.
And to come back up. I really felt like we have really are on the threshold of doing what was desired 30 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's taken us a while, but, you know, there was the federal constraints then, of the employment division and others. I can still remember some individuals, I won't name them, who suggested that they could not be a part of the department because it was all federal. You know, we had those issues. Then we, you know, everything was behind the confidentiality issues. You know, I could go on and on about some of the roadblocks. And when in 69, it was the Human Resources Coordination, and the legislature gave Nick Pete a really hard time because he proceeded to start with the department, and they said, we didn't give you the authority to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 71, we created the department, but still with all the barriers and everything in place. And so, you know, it's this evolution, and it's taken us 30 years to get to where.
Doug never hears those kinds of comments now, do you?
He never.
That's what happens when you have these historians here. Go ahead, Doug, so we can wrap this up.
Madam Chair, the last, just for those that don't mind, Senator, I think Duncan mentioned Leo Hegstrom, who died just recently.
I'm sorry, what?
Leo Hegstrom, you had mentioned, who died in the last few weeks.
I didn't know that.
Or I'm not sure, his funeral was, I believe, 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Gosh, I didn't know that.
So, the loss of the state. He had been the department's director for a number of years.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, the last item, and I have a handout for it here. This deals with 1999 Senate Bill 288, and that's the reference we use when we say this 288 report. Senate Bill 288 in 1999 repealed a provisional law that allowed workers' comp insurance premium refunds to certain rehab organizations. And these rehab organizations are many of the rehab organizations that serve our clients, including many of the small, I use the term of art, and I don't mean to be sheltered workshops, but in that term of art is old, and I don't always like to use it, but it, people understand it, as well as larger providers like Goodwill and of the various Goodwills across the state, Garten Foundation, and some of those. It repealed what was, they received refunds on their workers' comp premiums for our clients and other clients that they served. In that, it transferred $8.9 million to our department for two purposes. Basically, to provide in, during the 9901 biennium a distribution of about half of those funds based on a formula that we set up, and also then to take a look at the long-term future of how these providers would deal with the repeal of the premiums. And that long-term strategy is something that we're presenting to the legislature this session. We have presented this report to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, Senator Fisher's committee, and you should have a letter, I believe, at your desks that is their response to, or their recommendation to you on what has to be done. Let me go over the background briefly on this. The bill, Senate Bill 288, required approximately half of the funds to be distributed to the affected facilities during this current biennium, and we have done that. Approximately $4.5 million was distributed to them to compensate these facilities for premium refunds that were lost through the repeal of the law. We then had a task group put together that included DAS, LFO, ourselves, and providers. And I believe that group, the formal members of that group, are on the last page of the handout I gave you. It includes state folks as well as the providers that are listed on this page, which included a number of statewide providers. And they worked on putting together a plan to provide a cushion or a long-term solution to the loss of these funds. And that's what we're presenting to you today, is that plan. And our plan is that we are suggesting, and this is the work product of this group, to set up a self-insurance pool that we estimate will cost about $1.1 million to provide a long-term solution to the problem and provide assistance to many of these. Many of them are small providers, and there are many larger providers. And that would set up a self-insurance pool. It would be a voluntary pool. It would have to meet all of the requirements for such a self-insurance pool that the Department of Consumer and Business Services have, and we could expand that potential benefit beyond the original group of providers that had lost their refunds if new providers came on or different rehab service providers. But it is a voluntary. If that pool was not established, or you don't agree with that, then the funds would be distributed, the remaining $4.5 million, in the same way we did it this biennium, on in terms of just a proportional based on the number of clients and things that we distributed the funds. There are, like I said, there's a $1.1 million price tag to the self-insurance pool. There's two ways to do that. One is to find $1.1 million of new general fund dollars to finance that pool and let it go forward and distribute the $4.5 million the way we've done it this biennium. Or the second option would be to use part of that $4.5 million, establish the pool at the cost of $1.1 million estimated, and then distribute the rest proportionally. And that is what the work group recommended or reported out. We reported that to the Senate Policy Committee, chaired by Senator Fisher, and that letter's in front of you, and generally they tend to agree with that with one major exception, and that would be to say that, this is on page 2 of their letter, basically the last sentence in that first full paragraph: in addition, the plan presented by DHS must be modified so that the rehabilitation service providers that choose not to join the pool would receive their full allocation of funds.
Doug,
This is on this letter, I'm sorry.
Backside of
it. Yeah, backside.
So what the committee is recommending here is that instead of taking $1.1 million out of that $4.5 and establishing a pool, saying that the folks that do not want to participate in the pool and
they get their full.
They would get their full allocation. Our fear is that that would not leave that potentially, depending on what providers opt out, that there wouldn't be the sufficient amount of money. We don't know if that would happen because we don't know what providers at this time would opt out. We present that as concern to you. You have a couple options. You can sort of go ahead with the recommendation of the committee and see what happens. You can go ahead with the recommendation that the work group that we presented to the Senate committee was, which is to use $1.1 million, or you may decide not to do anything, and then the funds would be allocated as they were this binding. The full 4.5 would go, would be distributed out. Before making that decision, I think you probably should take the time to talk to some of the groups that are involved in this, both some of the larger providers, like Goodwill Industries and those, as well as some of the smaller providers in the DD community and the mental health community that are represented by the, I'm sure I get the title, Tim Crawl's group, which is the Oregon Rehab Association, to get both sides of the story on this. And I would urge you to do that or have them visit you on that issue before you make the final decision. This is a workers' comp. As we all know, workers' comp can get expensive for any business, including these businesses or these organizations.
Senator Shields.
Yes, Madam Chair. I was on Senator Fisher's committee. We spent a lot of time on this bill. It is complicated, and I hope that you would call, as Doug has suggested, Kim Crawl and some others that live and breathe this stuff before us, before we make a decision.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Shields.
Doug, this heading that you gave us, this last one, was three reports to the legislature. You know, the general category, not the worker.
Right.
We may have to.
I would like to suggest, Madam Chair, I'd like to suggest that there might even be another report that, and it's not a big deal, but because charitable choice was a mandate from the federal government under the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, and because in 1999 we passed SJR 25, and because part of SJR 25, which directed the Department of Human Resources to begin a dialogue with the faith community, part of it had a directive that DHR, then now DHS, report back to the emergency board, which Gary Weeks did in September of 2000. But it was a very abbreviated report, and he kind of just said, on that occasion, I'll get back to you. Because it was very difficult to bring together a broad-based community to begin the dialogue. Bobby Mink has it as a priority. He pulled a group together a couple weeks ago to try to begin again more conversations between DHS and the faith community, broadly defined. And so I would just hope that there would, at some point in time, you know, to maybe the emergency board, again, as Gary did, some kind of a report back on how that progress goes forward. And I just wanted to put that on the record.
We can note that. Since you were so good today. yeah. Even with all of your antics, we will not meet tomorrow.
We have full.
We have
eight,
full
so
to tomorrow. 8:30,
isn't
it? Because it's a large agenda tomorrow. But also begin to be prepared. We will begin work sessions on Monday. So please be here on time. And I need to talk to my...
It's on time, 8 or 8:30 nowadays. Monday.
Well, Monday is 8. Because I'm in the building. Tuesdays and Thursdays are bad because of caucus, but you know, I try to leave out of there. And I need to talk to my House side because it's critical now that we do have the members here as we begin to go through work session, and that we're here for the to begin the deliberation and vote. We will go, before we get into work session, we will review the process so that we all understand the methodology that we're going to go through, you know, in order to get our budgets completed. And I want to thank you for a lot of good hard work, Senator Yee.
Madam Chair, do we have a weekly...
I will get a schedule ready for you. I will have, we're putting the schedule together now so that we will know which agencies we're going to be working on.
Excuse me, it's Tuesday.
Oh, it's Tuesday, I'm sorry. Tuesday, I was just reminded it's Tuesday. We have to have a Monday to plan all this.
So
we're going to meet Monday. We have insurance pool.
It's insurance pool
for Monday. So you be here Monday at 8 o'clock.
No vacation for this group.
We are adjourned.